Disc 34.
Chapter 110. The Assizes. The Benedetto affair, as it was called in the Palais, and by people in general, had produced a tremendous sensation. Frequenting the Café de Paris, the Boulevard de Gand, and the Bois de Boulogne, during his brief career of splendour, the false Cavalcanti had formed a host of acquaintances. The papers had related his various adventures, both as the man of fashion and the galley-slave, and as everyone who had been personally acquainted with the Prince Cavalcanti experienced a lively curiosity in his fate, they all determined to spare no trouble in endeavouring to witness the trial of Monsieur Benedetto for the murder of his comrade. In the eyes of many, Benedetto appeared, if not a victim to, at least an instance of, the fallibility of the law. Monsieur Cavalcanti, his father, had been seen in Paris, and it was expected he would reappear to claim the illustrious outcast. Many also who were not aware of the circumstances attending his withdrawal from Paris were struck with the worthy appearance, the gentlemanly bearing, and the knowledge of the world displayed by the old patrician, who certainly played the nobleman very well, so long as he said nothing and made no arithmetical calculations. As for the accused himself, many remembered him as being so amiable, so handsome, and so liberal, that they chose to think him the victim of some conspiracy, since in this world large fortunes frequently excite the malevolence and jealousy of some unknown enemy. Everyone, therefore, ran to the court, some to witness the sight, others to comment upon it. From 7 o'clock in the morning a crowd was stationed at the iron gates, and an hour before the trial commenced the hall was full of the privileged. Beauchamp, one of the kings of the press, and therefore claiming the right of a throne everywhere, was looking round on every side. He perceived Chateaurenault and Debray, who had just gained the good graces of a sergeant de ville, and who had persuaded the latter to let them stand before instead of behind him, as he ought to have done. The worthy agent had recognised the minister's secretary and the millionaire, and by way of paying extra attention to his noble neighbours, promised to keep their places while they paid a visit to Beauchamp.
"Well," said Beauchamp, "we shall see our friend."
"Yes, indeed," replied Debray. "That worthy prince! Deuce take those Italian princes!"
"A man, too, who could boast of Dante for a genealogist, and could reckon as far back as the Divina Commedia."
"A nobility of the rope," said Chateaurenault phlegmatically. "He will be condemned, will he not?" asked Debray of Beauchamp.
"My dear fellow, I think we should ask you that question. You know such news much better than we do. Did you see the president at the minister's last night?"
"Yes."
"What did he say?"
"Something which will surprise you."
"Oh, make haste and tell me, then. It is a long time since that has happened."
"Well, he told me that Benedetto, who is considered a serpent of subtlety and a giant of cunning, is really but a very subordinate, silly rascal, and altogether unworthy of the experiments that will be made on his phrenological organs after his death."
"Bah," said Beauchamp. "He played the prince very well."
"Yes, for you who detest those unhappy princes, Beauchamp, and are always delighted to find fault with them. But not for me, who discover a gentleman by instinct, and who sent out an aristocratic family like a very bloodhound of heraldry."
"Then you never believed in the principality?"
"Yes, in the principality, but not in the prince."
"Not so bad," said Beauchamp. "Still, I assure you he passed very well with many people. I saw him at the ministers' houses."
"Ah, yes," said Chateaurenault. "The idea of thinking ministers understand anything about princes."
"There is something in what you have just said," said Beauchamp, laughing.
"But," said Debray to Beauchamp, "if I spoke to the president, you must have been with the procureur du roi."
"It was an impossibility. For the last week, Monsieur de Villefort has secluded himself. It is natural enough, this strange chain of domestic afflictions, followed by the no less strange death of his daughter."
"Strange? What do you mean, Beauchamp?"
"Oh, yes. Do you pretend that all this has been unobserved at the minister's?" said Beauchamp, placing his eyeglass in his eye, where he tried to make it remain.
"My dear sir," said Chateaurenault, "allow me to tell you that you do not understand that manoeuvre with the eyeglass half so well as Debray. Give him a lesson, Debray."
"Stay," said Beauchamp. "Surely I am not deceived."
"What is it?"
"It is she."
"Whom do you mean?"
"They said she had left."
"Mademoiselle Eugénie," said Chateaurenault. "Has she returned?"
"No, but her mother."
"Madame Danglars?" "Nonsense, impossible," said Chateaurenault. "Only 10 days after the flight of her daughter, and 3 days from the bankruptcy of her husband." Debray coloured slightly, and followed with his eyes the direction of Beauchamp's glance. come," he said. "It is only a veiled lady, some foreign princess, perhaps the mother of Cavalcanti. But hush, gentlemen, here is the court. Let us get back to our places."
A noise was heard in the hall. The sergeant de ville called his two protégés with an energetic "Hem!" and the doorkeeper appearing called out, with that shrill voice peculiar to his order, even in the days of Beaumarchais, "The court, gentlemen!" The judges took their places in the midst of the most profound silence. The jury took their seats. Monsieur de Villefort, the object of unusual attention, and we had almost said of general admiration, sat in the armchair and cast a tranquil glance around him. Every person looked with astonishment on that grave and severe face, the calm expression of which personal griefs had been unable to disturb, and the aspect of a man who was a stranger to all human emotions excited a kind of terror.
"Gendarmes," said the president, "lead in the accused."
At these words the public attention became more intense, and all eyes were turned towards the door through which Benedetto was to enter. The door soon opened, and the accused appeared. His features bore no sign of that deep emotion which stops the beating of the heart and blanches the cheek. His hands gracefully placed, one upon his hat, the other in the opening of his white waistcoat, were not at all tremulous. His eye was calm and even brilliant. Scarcely had he entered the hall when he glanced at the whole body of magistrates and assistants. His eye rested longer on the president, and still more so on the procureur du roi. By the side of Andrea was placed the lawyer who was to conduct his defence, and who had been chosen by the court. The president called for the deed of accusation, corrected, as we know, by the clever and implacable pen of de Villefort. During the reading of this, which was long, the public attention was continually drawn towards Andrea, who bore the burden with Spartan unconcern. Villefort had never been so concise and eloquent. The former life of the prisoner, his transformation, a review of his life from the earliest period, were set forth with all the talent that a knowledge of human life could furnish to a mind like that of the procureur du roi. Benedetto was thus for ever lost in public opinion before the sentence of the law could be pronounced. Andrea paid no attention to the successive charges which were brought against him. Monsieur de Villefort, who examined him attentively, and who no doubt practised upon him all the psychological studies he was accustomed to use, in vain endeavoured to make him lower his eyes, notwithstanding the depth and profundity of his gaze. At length the deed was read.
"Accused," said the president, "your name and surname."
Andrea rose.
"Excuse me, Monsieur le Président," he said in a clear voice, "but I see you are going to adopt a course of questions through which I cannot follow you. I have an idea, which I will explain by and by, of making an exception to the usual form of accusation. Allow me, then, if you please, to answer in different order, or I will not do so at all."
The astonished president looked at the jury, who themselves looked upon the procureur du roi. The whole assembly manifested great surprise. But Andrea appeared quite unmoved.
"Your age," said the president. "Will you answer that question?" "I will answer that question as well as the rest, Monsieur le Président, but in its turn." "Your age!" repeated the President. "I am 21 years old, or rather I shall be in a few days, as I was born the night of the 27th of September, 1817.
Monsieur de Villefort, who was busy taking down some notes, raised his head at the mention of this date.
"Where were you born?" continued the President. "At Auteuil, near Paris."
Monsieur de Villefort a second time raised his head, looked at Benedetto as if he had been gazing at the head of Medusa, and became livid. As for Benedetto, he gracefully wiped his lips with a fine cambric pocket handkerchief.
"Your profession?"
"First I was a forger," answered Andrea, as calmly as possible. "Then I became a thief, and lately have become an assassin."
A murmur, or rather storm of indignation, burst from all parts of the assembly. The judges themselves appeared stupefied, and the jury manifested tokens of disgust for a stoicism so unexpected from a fashionable man. Monsieur de Villefort pressed his hand upon his brow, which at first pale, had become red and burning. Then he suddenly rose and looked around as though he had lost his senses. He wanted air.
"Are you looking for anything, Monsieur le Procureur du Roi?" asked Benedetto, with his most pleasing smile.
Monsieur de Villefort answered nothing, but sat, or rather threw himself down again, upon his chair.
"And now, prisoner, will you consent to tell your name?"
said the President.
"The brutal affectation with which you have enumerated and classified your crimes calls for a severe reprimand on the part of the court,
both in the name of morality and for the respect due to humanity. You appear to consider this a point of honour, and it may be for this reason you have delayed acknowledging your name. You wished it to be preceded by all these titles.
It is quite wonderful, Monsieur le Président, how entirely you have read my thoughts, said Benedetto, in his softest voice and most polite manner. This is indeed the reason why I begged you to alter the order of the questions.
The public astonishment had reached its height. There was no longer any deceit or bravado in the manner of the accused. The audience seemed like some thundercloud about to burst over the gloomy scene.
Well, said the President, your name?
I cannot tell you my name, since I do not know it, but I know my father's, and will pronounce it.
Repeat your father's name, said the President.
Not a whisper, not a breath was heard in that vast assembly. Everyone waited anxiously.
My father is the Procureur du Roi, replied Andrea calmly.
The Procureur du Roi? Said the President,
stupefied, and without noticing the agitation which spread over the face of Monsieur de Villefort.
The Procureur du Roi?
Yes, and if you wish to know his name, I will tell it. He is named Villefort.
The explosion, which had been so long restrained from a feeling of respect to the Court of Justice, now burst forth like thunder from the breasts of all present. The court itself did not seek to restrain the movement of the multitude. The exclamations, the insults addressed to Benedetto, who remained perfectly unconcerned, the energetic gestures, the movement of the gendarmes, the sneers of the scum of the crowd, always sure to rise to the surface in case of any disturbance, all this lasted 5 minutes, before the doorkeepers and magistrates were able to restore silence. Several persons hurried up to Monsieur de Villefort, who was nearly buried in his chair, offering him consolation, encouragement, and protestations of zeal and sympathy. Order was re-established in the hall, with the exception of a few who still moved and whispered. A lady, it was said, had just fainted. They had supplied her with a smelling bottle, and she had recovered. During the scene of tumult, Andrea had turned his smiling face towards the assembly, then, leaning with one hand on the oaken rail of his bench, in the most graceful attitude possible, he said,
"Gentlemen, I assure you, I had no idea of insulting the court, or of making a useless disturbance in the presence of this honourable assembly. They ask my age, I tell it. They ask where I was born, I answer. They ask my name. I cannot give it, since my parents abandoned me. But though I cannot give my own name, not possessing one, I can tell them my father's. Now I repeat, my father is named Monsieur de Villefort, and I am ready to prove it."
There was an energy, a conviction, and a sincerity in the manner of the young man which silenced the tumult. All eyes were turned for a moment towards the Procureur du Roi, who sat as motionless as though a thunderbolt had changed him into a corpse.
"Gentlemen," said Andrea, commanding silence by his voice and manner, "I owe you the proofs and explanations of what I have said."
"But," said the irritated President, "you called yourself Benedetto, declared yourself an orphan, and claimed Corsica as your country."
"I said anything I pleased, in order that the solemn declaration I have just made should not be withheld, which otherwise would certainly have been the case. I now repeat that I was born at Auteuil on the night of the 27th of September, 1817, and that I am the son of the Procureur du Roi, Monsieur de Villefort. Do you wish for any further details? I will give them. I was born in No. 28 Rue de la Fontaine, in a room hung with red damask. My father took me in his arms, telling my mother I was dead, wrapped me in a napkin marked with an H and an N, and carried me into a garden where he buried me alive."
A shudder ran through the assembly when they saw that the confidence of the prisoner increased in proportion with the terror of Monsieur de Villefort.
"But how have you become acquainted with all these details?" asked the President.
"I will tell you, Monsieur le Président. A man who had sworn vengeance against my father, and had long watched his opportunity to kill him, had introduced himself that night into the garden in which my father buried me. He was concealed in a thicket. He saw my father bury something in the ground, and stabbed him in the midst of the operation. Then, thinking the deposit might contain some treasure, he turned up the ground and found me still living. The man carried me to the hospital for enfants trouvés, where I was inscribed under the number 37. 3 months afterwards, a woman travelled from Rogliano to Paris to fetch me, and having claimed me as her son, carried me away. Thus, you see, though born in Paris, I was brought up in Corsica."
There was a moment's silence, during which one could have fancied the hall empty, so profound was the stillness.
"Proceed," said the President. "Certainly, I might have lived happily amongst those good people who adored me, but my perverse disposition prevailed over the virtues which my adopted mother endeavoured to instil into my heart. I increased in wickedness, till I committed crime. One day, when I cursed Providence for making me so wicked and ordaining me to such a fate, my adopted father said to me, 'Do not blaspheme, unhappy child. The crime is your father's, not yours. Your father's, who devoted you to death or to a life of misery, in case by a miracle you should escape his doom.' Since then I ceased to blaspheme, but I cursed my father. This is why I have uttered the words for which you blame me. This is why I have filled this whole assembly with horror. If I have committed an additional crime, punish me. But if you will allow that ever since the day of my birth my fate has been sad, bitter, and lamentable, then pity me.' 'But your mother?' asked the President. 'My mother thought me dead. She is not guilty. I did not even wish to know her name, nor do I know it.'" Just then a piercing cry, ending in a sob, burst from the centre of the crowd, who encircled the lady who had before fainted, and who now fell into a violent fit of hysterics. She was carried out of the hall, and in doing so the thick veil which concealed her face dropped off, and Madame Danglars was recognised. Notwithstanding his shattered nerves, the stunning sensation in his ears, and the species of madness which turned his brain, Villefort rose as he perceived her. "The proofs! The proofs!" said the President. "Remember, this tissue of horrors must be supported by the clearest proofs." "The proofs?" said Benedetto, laughing. "Do you want proofs?"
"Yes."
"Well, then, look at Monsieur de Villefort, and then ask me for proofs." Everyone turned towards the Procureur du Roi, who, unable to bear the universal gaze now riveted on him alone, advanced staggering into the midst of the tribunal, with his hair dishevelled and his face indented with the mark of his nails. The whole assembly uttered a long murmur of astonishment.
"Father," said Benedetto, "I am asked for proofs. Do you wish me to give them?"
"No, no, it is useless," stammered Monsieur de Villefort in a hoarse voice. "No, it is useless."
"How useless?" cried the President. "What do you mean?"
"I mean that I feel it impossible to struggle against this deadly weight which crushes me. Gentlemen, I know I am in the hands of an avenging God. We need no proofs. Everything relating to this young man is true."
A dull, gloomy silence, like that which precedes some awful phenomenon of nature, pervaded the assembly, who shuddered in dismay.
"What, Monsieur de Villefort," cried the President, "do you yield to hallucination? What, are you no longer in possession of your senses? This strange, unexpected, terrible accusation has disordered your reason. Come, recover."
The Procureur du Roi dropped his head. His teeth chattered like those of a man under a violent attack of fever, and yet he was deadly pale.
"I am in possession of all my senses, sir," he said. "My body alone suffers, as you may suppose. I acknowledge myself guilty of all the young man has brought against me, and from this hour hold myself under the authority of the Procureur du Roi, who will succeed me."
And as he spoke these words, with a hoarse, choking voice, he staggered towards the door, which was mechanically opened by a doorkeeper. The whole assembly were dumb with astonishment at the revelation and confession which had produced a catastrophe so different to that which had been expected during the last fortnight by the Parisian world.
"The sitting is adjourned, gentlemen," said the President. "Fresh inquiries will be made, and the case will be tried next session by another magistrate."
As for Andrea, who was as calm and more interesting than ever, he left the hall escorted by gendarmes who involuntarily paid him some attention.
"Well, what do you think of this, my fine fellow?" asked Debray of the Sergeant de Ville, slipping a louis into his hand.
"There will be extenuating circumstances," he replied.